Case number 19-3500, State of Ohio et al. Versus EPA et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Flowers, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you, Chief Judge Cole, and may it please the court, Ben Flowers for Ohio and Tennessee. I'll do my best to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
I'd like to begin by explaining why we still care about this case, since I think that goes to mootness, which I take to be the biggest remaining issue. Although the agencies repealed and replaced the 2015 rule, their shifted position is reasonably likely to be enjoined in one of the many cases pending around the country. If that happens, the rule goes back into effect. We need an injunction now because we will suffer future imminent harms if it goes into effect, and we're currently suffering continuing present harms from the 2015 rule. So I can take those in turn. The future imminent harms are maybe the more obvious ones. If the rule goes back into effect, which could happen at any moment, we will once again be subject to the loss of sovereignty that comes with the rule's broader definition of navigable waters, as well as the administrative costs that come with the more expansive definition. But there are continuing present harms.
Mr. Flowers, could I interrupt you, please? I mean, I understand the parade of horribles that are all preceded by if. I get that. I'm not quibbling whether you're right or wrong about that. But what relief could we grant you today that would not be an advisory opinion, given the fact that the revocation order has not been ruled improper? And so there, you want us to give you an injunction with respect to a rule that as of today is not in effect.
So I'll take that in two steps. First, explaining what the relief we want is, and then second, the continuing harms, which I think illustrate why it wouldn't be advisory, but would keep us from being injured now. So the ruling would simply be an injunction barring the enforcement of the 2015 rule. The reason that's relevant, the reason it remedies current harm, is that today, 27 states in the country have an injunction of just that nature. It's in effect. We are at a competitive disadvantage relative to those states because whereas businesses can go into those states, including our neighbor states like Indiana in our case, or Georgia and Alabama's in Tennessee's case, and they know that they can plan projects and do business without having to worry about these rules springing back into effect, that's not the case with us. Second, we currently need to prepare and budget for the possible reimplementation of these rules that could happen at any moment. Now, I take Your Honor's point that, at least with respect to the future imminent harms, there's something of an if. Preceding the injuries I was talking about. I don't think that's true with the continuing present harms, but even putting those aside, one way to think about the case is to ask what would happen if later today, and there will be a preliminary injunction hearing today in the Northern District of California in one of these cases, if an injunction issues. I think every party to this case would acknowledge that at that point, the case isn't moot. Well, if it wouldn't be moot in a few hours if that were to happen, then it's not moot now. It can't go in and out of mootness. And that brings me to the doctrine. The question,
Mr. Flowers, just on that point, do you know how many of these cases are pending where parties in California, Hawaii, or Maryland, or wherever are seeking to enjoin the rule nationwide?
I have.
And whether, in fact, they are seeking a nationwide injunction.
I have our best calculation of the matter, which is 10 suits challenging the new Waters of the United States rule, 5 challenging the suspension rule, and 4 in which both are at issue. With respect to national injunction.
What about the repeal rule? Isn't that the one that actually kicked in 2019 and makes this not effective at the moment?
I'm sorry, I may have misspoken. So that's the one in which there are 5 currently pending cases challenging that repeal rule, including one that the interveners are involved in. The repeal rule cases seem to be stayed or at least moving slowly to see what happens with the new definition cases. But again, some of these cases are combined too.
Are the parties seeking nationwide injunctions, do you know offhand, in most or all these cases?
In at least some cases, yes. So definitely the case that will be decided today, that is how we read the complaints in the repeal rule case that the interveners are involved in too. And even if they're not seeking it, the court would be able to issue it. I think one, when we look at mootness, Your Honors, and this returns to Judge McKeague's point to some extent. Voluntary cessation moots a case only if there is no reasonable expectation of the conducts recurring. And Speech First makes clear that you look at the totality of the circumstances. There are 3 circumstances that I think are particularly relevant in this case. First, the sheer number of challenges, and they only need to prevail in one if they get a universal injunction. Second, the rise in popularity of universal injunctions. And third, the fact that you have the United States here, the Army Corps and the EPA before you, seeking to dismiss a case that they say is not constitutionally moot on a prudential doctrine. The only reason I can imagine why the agencies would do that is to preserve the flexibility for those in the EPA who want to reimpose these rules to do so at a future date. All of this, I think, distinguishes this case from the Winsberg case, which is a Tenth Circuit decision the United States relies on for prudential mootness purposes. In that case, it was an opinion by then Judge Gorsuch. What the Tenth Circuit said is usually a coordinate branches providing relief will moot a case, but there's an exception. It won't do it if there's a perceptible chance that the coordinate branches' efforts will fail. Well, here there's far more than a perceptible chance. I don't think we have to close our eyes on what's gone over the past 4 years with administrative challenges and universal injunctions. We have this rule ready to spring back into effect in Ohio and Tennessee. That's harming us now. It will imminently harm us in the future. And until we obtain an injunction, we are not in the same position as our 27 sister states that have one.
But back to my question, Mr. Flowers, you're asking us then to grant an injunction that would become effective if, for any number of different reasons, I suppose, the rule came back into effect, right?
Well, the injunction would be effective now, just as the injunctions are still in place in those cases I discussed with our 27 sister states. So what it would say is you, EPA, and Army Corps may not enforce this against Ohio and Tennessee. Now, they may not want to enforce it yet, or they may not have the means to do it. But much like in a pre-enforcement challenge, which indisputably they're standing to bring, there's no mootness issue, you would say you're not to enforce that, you know, come the effective date. It would work in much the same way here. And that's why I think we do not suffer from the mootness problems that my friends on the other side point to.
Let's say that the Northern District of California enters a nationwide injunction against the effectiveness of the repeal rule. Let's say they do that, you know, in the next week. Then how, just walk me through how this court, I'm not doubting it, but the manner in which this court enters some decision which provides relief to you in that circumstance. Is it simply that the rule's invalid on a ground other than its repeal, I guess?
If I'm understanding the question, it's how would this court write the opinion so that it's meaningful for us?
I'm just trying to make sure in the event of a nationwide injunction against repeal of the rule that we would even be in a position to afford you relief, given the sort of omnipotent nature of these nationwide injunctions.
So you would be in a position to provide us relief because even if the courts, we're not collaterally attacking those decisions. So let's assume the repeal rules enjoined and the final rule redefining waters of the United States are enjoined. What your injunction would say is that's fine, but you also can't enforce the 2015 rules, which would put us back in the status quo as it existed pre-2015. That's what the agencies did with respect to the states that won preliminary injunctions. So they're back in the pre-2015 world, at least they were until the repeal rule and the new definitions took effect. Okay. And that's why it would be meaningful for us. I see that I have a few minutes left before I start eating into my rebuttal time. I'm happy to talk more about mootness, but otherwise I can move on and say a little bit about the merits. The government, for its part, acknowledges the illegality of the 2015 rule. The interveners defend it, but respectfully, we think they come up short. They don't argue that if the Rapinos plurality controls that the rule is valid. And I don't think there's any serious argument that it is. But they do argue that it satisfies Justice Kennedy's significant nexus test. And we think that's incorrect for a few reasons. First, if you look at the rule's definitions of tributaries, it says that all tributaries, no matter how minor the flow contribution and no matter how indirect the connection to navigable waters, come within the definition of waters of the United States. That's exactly the kind of tributary that Justice Kennedy himself said would not satisfy his test. You look at the adjacency definition. All waters that are within a certain distance of other waters categorically qualify as waters of the United States without regard to the effect on those other waters. That's going to count the same isolated ponds that Swank held are not waters of the United States and that Justice Kennedy in his concurrence recognized again would not be waters of the United States. Finally, there's the case-by-case analysis. Though it uses some of the same language as Justice Kennedy's opinion, it is something of an imposter. And the reason for that is it's easy to satisfy. It includes waters, again, like the isolated ponds and swank. To show a significant nexus, all you have to show under the case-by-case analysis in the rules is that that water combined with other waters in the region, which means the same watershed, will have a significant effect on just one of numerous aquatic functions. One of those aquatic functions is the provision of life cycle dependent aquatic habitat, including for breeding, spawning, and nesting. Well, that's the isolated ponds and swank. Those ponds provided a rookery for great blue heron. So again, it ropes in many waters, all three of these categories that would not be covered by his test. The APA problem, there are two. First, the final rule is not a logical outgrowth of the proposed rule. With respect to adjacency, the proposed rule suggested defining adjacent waters using only hydrological and ecological connections. And the final rule ditched that and replaced it with a definition that was entirely based on distances from other waters. Also, the proposed rule suggested you could find tributaries using remote sensing and desktop tools. So to supplement the field observation or in place of a field observation.
Chief Judge Cole, I don't know if we're out of town. Okay, we got a minute.
We're close.
Let me just ask you a quick question, Mr. Flowers. Are you in a position, is the state in a position in this appeal with respect to the harm that, you know, the harm prong of the injunctive test? Is the state in a position to invoke the liberty interests of its citizens, not in a Lochner sense, but just the restriction upon their freedom that would result by the terms of the rule? Or are you limited in some way just to these sort of sovereignty and state cost concerns?
I think both. We are certainly making the sovereignty argument. That's been the focus of our argument. But under Massachusetts v. EPA, I think the states would be able to assert harms to their citizens and litigate those matters too.
It's been a few months since I had to deal with that case.
In Massachusetts v. EPA, I believe it was, and I admit it's been a while since I've looked at it too, but if I'm not mistaken, it was harm to citizens' property that would come from rising waters from
global. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Flowers. You'll have a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Left. We'll hear next from, I'm not sure which of the appellees will be proceeding first.
Ms. McLaughlin.
McLaughlin, okay. I think you've allocated yourself 8 minutes and you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Jolie McLaughlin, on behalf of Interveners, Natural Resources Defense Council, and National Wildlife Federation. I'd like to first address a question that Judge McKeague asked, which is, what relief could a preliminary injunction provide the states with now? And the answer to that question is nothing. The rule that the states are seeking to preliminarily enjoin no longer exists. And under this court has explained in, for example, Brandywine versus City of Richmond, that it cannot enjoin enforcement of a provision that's no longer in effect. There's an exception to that, the voluntary cessation principle that Mr. Flowers mentioned. And the purpose of that exception is to ensure that the defendants are not evading judicial review. And that applies when there's a reasonable expectation that the government is going to reenact the policy. There's no question that the federal government here has no intention of reenacting the Clean Water Rule. And thus the policy change was genuine in the sense that it was not intended to evade judicial review. And that provides a secure foundation for dismissal under this court's precedent. Yes.
Ms. McLaughlin, it seems, I mean, this is an unusual case. It's an unusual factual scenario. It seems like the vastly more likely way, at least for the time being, that this rule would come into effect is not through the executive changing its mind, but through the judiciary entering a nationwide injunction. Would you concede that the case is not moot if this afternoon or on Monday the appeal grants a nationwide injunction?
No, that is not true. This case would still be moot because the hearing today is over the new replacement rule. If the court grants an injunction against the new replacement rule, that means the repeal rule goes back into effect, not the clean water rule.
If in one of the five suits apparently involving the repeal rule, if a district court purported to enter a nationwide injunction against the effect of the repeal rule, would you agree in that instance that this appeal is no longer moot?
If and when that were to happen, but right now that would require predicting the likely outcome of those cases. And that is inherently speculative.
But you know, I mean, it is settled law at this point that once a plaintiff proves standing, that it is a significantly more relaxed showing necessary to avoid a determination of mootness. And I guess, I mean, I totally get your point that the rule's not in effect today, and that's a very powerful point. But at the same time, I mean, these nationwide injunctions, whether one likes them or not, have sprung up like dandelions across the country for the last 3 years. And why should we not take into account or take seriously the idea that there is a likelihood of recurrence with the rule's effect by means of one of these nationwide injunctions?
Again, I would say because that necessarily requires speculation on the outcome of other cases.
That's always true in a mootness case where we are evaluating the likelihood of recurrence.
Yes, and under those contexts,
they say we're pretty relaxed. They're much more tolerant of speculation in mootness than in standing. I mean, that's just black letter law.
And at least the cases that I've seen where the court is asking whether it's reasonably likely to reoccur, it's talking about whether the government or the defendant is likely to reengage in the conduct. And that's because the whole purpose of the voluntary cessation exception is to ensure evasion of judicial review. I haven't seen any cases where courts simply scan the horizon to see what other possible ways could result in a law or rule coming back into effect.
Why would we if there is actually sort of an obvious and existing means in the form of lawsuits that in which the same parties in this case are involved in that case? Why would we pretend that doesn't exist?
Because speculation about events that may or may not ever come to pass would be advisory. And I would like to emphasize here that the states are seeking preliminary relief. And that's important because that means the rule can only come back into effect if two rounds of litigation is successful, litigation challenging the repeal rule and the replacement rule. And because of the status of the repeal rule challenges, which are, as Mr. Flowers mentioned, for the most part stayed, and no one has sought to preliminarily enjoin the repeal rule. No one has sought even summary judgment in those cases yet. So regardless of their likely outcome, it's extremely unlikely that they could both be decided before the district court in this case has an opportunity to decide the merits of the state's lawsuit. And that's important. That means that there's no immediate risk of the Clean Water Rule coming back into effect. And that shows that this court cannot provide effective preliminary relief to the state, which is the only issue before this court. And it also shows there's simply no immediate risk of harm here. And that's necessary to justify the extraordinary relief that the states are seeking. It's their burden, if this court does decide that it's not moot, it's their burden to show that they are likely to face immediate irreparable harm from a rule that's not currently in effect and may never go back into effect. They've cited certain current purported harms that they're facing. Those were never before the district court. And if they are citing present harms, which is unclear how that could happen because the rule is not in effect, that would be a reason to remand so that the district court consider those harms in the first instance.
I appreciate your procedural point. And that's a significant point that maybe if we look at the dockets, those other courts might not act before the district court would act on a permanent injunction or something like that. But do you happen to know whether in those five other cases, anyone is seeking a preliminary injunction with nationwide effect?
No one has sought a preliminary injunction. Those have been pending for about 8 months now. And those are essentially on ice until the replacement rule litigation can be resolved. And I would also, to your point about the immediate harm that the states must show is likely to occur, this court has explained time and again that for preliminary relief, immediate harm must be actual. It cannot be speculative or hypothetical. And the state's only claim as to why relief is required here is that courts may decide to enjoin the replacement and repeal rule in the future. And preliminary injunctions are supposed to protect plaintiffs facing immediate concrete harm. They are not
One thing that confused me that you said a minute ago is you were stressing how this comes to us from the standpoint of the denial of preliminary injunctive relief. And I gathered that your thinking was, if we deny this, it goes back, it's hanging around the district court. And if something changes in these other states with a national injunction, for example, for the revocation rule, then the state can take their concerns back to the district judge. But if you're right that this case is either constitutionally or prudentially moot because the rule is no longer in effect, wouldn't our proper remedy there be to vacate the decision but remand it back to the district court to dismiss the case because it's moot? In other words, mootness is not a concept here that's just attached to preliminary injunctive relief, as I understand these arguments. Mootness is attached to whether the whole case is moot. So at that point, the case gets dismissed at the district court based on our instruction. And now all of a sudden, Mr. Flowers is going to say, well, wait a minute. I tried to get relief for 2 years. I just couldn't get a hearing in court. Now you've thrown me out of court. The rule is now back in effect in Ohio, and I got to start over.
Thank you. Our position is that the entire case is moot, but the question for this court is simply whether the request for preliminary relief is moot. And this court can decide whether the question of preliminary relief is moot without deciding whether the entire case is moot, and can leave that for the district court to decide. And
well, I don't know why we would do that. I mean,
how do we do that? It's either moot or it's not moot.
I mean, if we're going to get into mootness, I would think we're going to determine, number one, whether the case is moot. And if it's not moot, then is a request for preliminary injunction, perhaps, as the department says, prudentially moot. But the idea that we're just going to say this is moot, but we're going to be a cipher as to whether the case goes forward, I don't see how that helps anybody here.
I believe that because it's the posture of it's come up to the court on the question of preliminary relief. The Ninth Circuit, for example, what we attached to our 28J letter, dismissed the decision to grant preliminary injunction as moot. It did not dismiss the entire case. And I believe this court could decide the same thing. But of course, if it believes that the entire case is moot, it could decide that as well.
We could, obviously. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McLaughlin. Appreciate your argument. Mr. Lundman?
Yes, may it please the court. Robert Lundman, representing EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers. As the court has already discussed, we are arguing that the case is prudentially moot. And by the case, we mean the preliminary injunction appeal before the court right now. Just to be clear, the hearing later today in Northern District of California concerns only the navigable waters protection, the new rule with the new definition of waters of the United States. The plaintiffs in that case, a number of states, have not sought a preliminary injunction against the repeal rule. And so there's no imminent threat of relief that would bring back the 2015 rule from that case as a result. The state of Ohio and state of Tennessee have both filed oppositions to the preliminary injunction motion as well in that case. And the federal government and presumably the states are hopeful as well that the preliminary injunction will be denied there.
So, Mr. London, if I may, I'm going to try to summarize the status quo, and please tell me if you think I'm mistaken in any way. The repeal rule has, in fact, taken effect as of, I think, December 2019, which means that the regulation at issue here is not in effect anywhere, I guess. Meanwhile, the new rule, for lack of a better term, I think it became final at some point, but there are 10 cases seeking to enjoin its effect. If a court enjoins the effect of the new rule, then the repeal rule would remain effective. And I guess we're talking about whatever the reg that was before the Waters of the U.S. rule here. That's the one that currently is in effect, or that's the one that would be in effect, right? In the event that somebody gets a nationwide injunction in one of these cases about the new rule. I know that's convoluted, but is that right?
That's right. So if there's a preliminary nationwide injunction against the new rule, then the 1980s regulatory system that's been in place up until 2015 would be in place.
Thank you.
And you mentioned 10 cases against the new rule. I'm not sure if I've got the count exactly right, but it's around there. There are three pending preliminary injunction motions right now. The one we talked about in Northern District of California with a hearing, one that's fully briefed in the District of Colorado, but no hearing date has been set. Groups of cattlemen's associations and cattle growers in New Mexico have filed for a very limited preliminary injunction. They think the rule is too expansive. The new rule should be even narrower. And that's being briefed now without a hearing date. If they got the relief they sought, it would be a small change to the rule. The Colorado case does not seek a nationwide injunction. They're the state of Colorado seeking an injunction that would apply only in the state of Colorado, while the Northern District of California case, they are seeking a nationwide injunction. A number of states.
Mr. London, rather than you take up your time for us to ask you questions going through these 10 cases, I have two questions for you. Why do you focus on prudential mootness and not constitutional mootness?
Well, I think this is a rare case where there's just a shifting legal landscape that is less firm than is usually the case after the federal government has promulgated rules. We know with the 2015 rule that it was enjoined in several states, but not nationwide at any point. We know with the applicability date rule that it was enjoined nationwide. And so we think the best course here is to dismiss the appeals prudentially moot, send it back to the district court. And there, if there is a development, the district court is better suited than a court of appeals to react to a fast moving development that might bring this case back into a sharper need for an injunction for the state of Ohio and state of Tennessee.
So are you saying that if we sent the case back, say, in connection with this preliminary injunctive relief question, finding the case to be prudentially moot, is the case then still pending in the district court? And how can that be?
There have been a number of district courts who have challenges to the 2015 rule, the same rule, who have simply stayed proceedings to wait and see what happens, because this is a complicated rulemaking situation with multiple rules. Some district courts have dismissed the whole case as moot, but others have stayed proceedings. The government has not opposed stays in those cases. As Mr. Flowers pointed out, we the government have repealed the 2015 rule. We're not looking to defend it anymore. We're aware that folks, though, like the states here, are concerned about it coming back. And we think leaving the cases open because of the uncertain legal landscape is sensible.
My second question along those same lines then is, if you say you have no intention of reinstating the rule, and I take it your word for that, why are you even defending this on the basis of mootness? Why do you care?
Well, there's two reasons. One, we think prudential mootness is the right answer here. So that's why we've briefed it. And second, we don't think it makes any sense to have the court, this court or any court, when we have a whole new rulemaking with a whole new administrative record, establish a new substantive rule. We want to defend the new rule. We don't want to defend or actually not defend the 2015 rule based on an administrative record that the agencies now say they disagree with. This case is stale. And we don't think a court needs to wade into whether the 2015 rule was or was not proper when there's a substantive fight on the new rule that makes sense for courts to resolve, and that the government would rather defend that because it's the government's current best thinking on what waters the United States should need. And so that's why we think it makes sense to not decide the merits of this case when there's no imminent need for relief, for this court to dismiss as prudentially moot, for the district court then potentially to stay to make sure nothing else develops, and for then the litigation involving the new rules to go forward.
I think Chief Judge Cole had a question.
That's all right. We can move on. Thanks.
Okay. I guess, Mr. London, I want to ask you about, well, first of all, I mean, I think that for the reasons that Ms. McLaughlin said, it would seem quite possible that a request for a preliminary injunction might be prudentially moot if we agree that there is such a thing as prudential mootness, but the underlying case might not. I mean, if the reasons are specific to the time dockets and that kind of thing, the sort of immediate relief right now might be prudentially moot, but a request for a permanent injunction might not be constitutionally moot. Would you agree or disagree with that?
We have not addressed constitutional mootness in our brief.
Okay, but what do you think?
The short answer is it would depend on the status of the rules at the time. You know, that if preliminary injunctions are all denied, we move to summary judgment quickly. We could have an answer on the status of the both the navigable waters protection rule and potentially the repeal rule fairly soon in those cases. And I think where those cases are in the process, whether there's any relief awarded against them, whether there's still outstanding requests for relief in Ohio or Tennessee, I think all of that matters. And so I'm not able to prejudge where the government would turn out, okay. What the government would say about constitutional.
I get it. Is the protection rule currently in effect? What's the status quo with that?
On Monday, June 22nd is the effective date.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'll read the newspapers this weekend and see where we're at.
Right. I think all the parties will inform the court quickly if there's any injunctions.
I don't want to, if somebody else has a question, I'll.
One quick question. Mr. Lemon, if we were to dismiss under prudential mootness, would you have us just leave the district court to, to its own devices at this point? Or would you want there to be some sort of remand as opposed to, I guess, dismissal, where we at least give some sort of direction to the district court in terms of what it should be doing, if anything?
I think the government thinks that dismissal with just a straight remand is sufficient here. I think in the first instance then, Mr. Flowers in the state of Tennessee as well would decide whether to seek additional relief, another preliminary injunction if developments warranted it, if the rules were stayed or enjoined nationwide or in Ohio or Tennessee. So I think the short answer is just we'd be happy with a straight up dismissal and remand and then let the district court sort out all the potential issues and problems that could develop.
And the district court would not be able to do that until one of you takes some sort of action that brings it to its attention, I would assume.
Right. I mean, I think the parties could either push forward to the merits, agree to stay the case, or a new injunction motion could be filed if something occurred with respect to the new rules.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Just I want to ask you about prudential mootness itself. I mean, so we have the 10th Circuit case. There's an older D.C. Circuit case. I mean, this isn't like Supreme Court has not blessed this doctrine as far as I can tell. And I'm trying to it seems like an odd doctrine to me. I mean, what is, why wouldn't, instead of saying the case is prudentially moot because the relief is not going to be very effective or very important for the party seeking it, why wouldn't we say on the merits of the preliminary injunction motion, basically what the district court said, which is there's no reason to grant the motion for precisely that same reason. Why wouldn't we just deny or affirm the denial of the motion because under these circumstances, the relief is not going to do any good, assuming there's still Article III jurisdiction, rather than say we're not, I mean, rather than just write a different opinion that says we're not going to adjudicate the motion because the relief's not going to do any good.
Well, I think those, it's a fine line between the two paths you laid out. We think prudential mootness, you know, we think this court has recognized it in the Greenbaum v. EPA decision and discussed it as well in other cases. The 10th Circuit opinion referenced by then Judge Gorsuch, you know, I think is a thorough discussion of why it makes sense when events have so overtaken an appeal to stay the court's equitable hand, which sounds very much like staying the court's equitable hand with respect to the preliminary injunction itself. I think in this preliminary injunction context, it's a very fine line between saying prudentially moot or we're going to stay our equitable hand with respect to the relief of a preliminary injunction.
I'm just trying to figure out where that line is, or
Yeah, I think given the court has recognized prudential mootness, I think this case is a real good example of why sometimes it makes sense for the Court of Appeals to say we don't need to decide this right now. Relief isn't required right now. The district court can sort this out and take into account what happens in the pending lawsuits, which all the parties agree there are many.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lundman. Your time has expired. Appreciate it. Mr. Flowers, you have a couple of minutes rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to make just three quick points, actually starting, Chief Judge Cole, with your question about what to say. Even if you say that the case is prudentially moot, as a bare minimum, we ask that you vacate the decision below, because the reasoning in that decision is fundamentally flawed, and it's not if it's not corrected, then it's unclear how anything better could happen on remand. The district court said that we weren't being irreparably injured because the agencies were trying to get rid of the rule at the time. That just doesn't make any sense. We were being injured at the time, and it's true they were trying to fix that, but they had not yet. The second point is also about prudential mootness. I don't think you can separate prudential and constitutional mootness in this case. Constitutional mootness asks whether it's impossible to give us relief. Prudential mootness asks whether it's impossible to give us meaningful relief. But the same injuries are going to both doctrines. The reason it's meaningful for us is because it frees us from the ongoing harm of having to worry about this coming back and budgeting for that and hiring for that. It eliminates the competitive disadvantage of the other states, and then the future imminent harms as well associated with loss of sovereignty and administrative costs. And finally, Judge McKeague, you asked about how would constitutional mootness work here. I'm not aware of any way that the preliminary injunction request could be constitutionally moot without the entire case being constitutionally moot. If it's possible to give us relief, then it's possible to give us that relief now. And so it's neither moot, the whole case isn't moot, and neither is the request for a preliminary injunction. And if there are no further questions, we ask that you reverse the district court, or in the alternative, at bare minimum, vacate its decision and instruct it to perform the proper preliminary injunction analysis on remand.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to thank all three of you for your arguments this afternoon. Again, as I mentioned the last argument, I think that the arguments have proceeded well logistically in terms of the video aspect of it. So again, we thank you for your cooperation and proceeding in this fashion. With that, the case will be submitted, and the clerk may call the final case.